Preface. How to Read a Book was first published in the early months of 1940. To my surprise, and I confess to my delight, it immediately became a bestseller and remained at the top of the nationwide bestseller list for more than a year. Since 1940, it has continued to be widely circulated in numerous printings, both hardcover and paperback, and it has been translated into other languages: French, Swedish, German, Spanish, and Italian. Why then attempt to recast and rewrite the book for the present generation of readers? The reasons for doing so lie in changes that have taken place, both in our society in the last 30 years and in the subject itself. Today, many more of the young men and women who complete high school enter and complete 4 years of college. A much larger proportion of the population has become literate, in spite of, or even because of, the popularity of radio and television. There's been a shift of interest from the reading of fiction to the reading of non-fiction. The educators of the country have acknowledged that teaching the young to read, in the most elementary sense of that word, is our paramount educational problem. A recent secretary of the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, designating the 70s as the decade of reading, has dedicated federal funds in support of a wide variety of efforts to improve proficiency in this basic skill. And many of those efforts have scored some success at the level at which children are initiated into the art of reading. In addition, adults in large numbers have been captivated by the glittering promises made by speed reading courses, promises to increase their comprehension of what they read, as well as their speed in reading it. However, certain things have not changed in the last 30 years. One constant is that, to achieve all the purposes of reading, the desideratum must be the ability to read different things at different, appropriate speeds, not everything at the greatest possible speed. As Pascal observed 300 years ago, when we read too fast or too slowly, we understand nothing. Since speed reading has become a national fad, this new edition of How to Read a Book deals with the problem and proposes variable speed reading as the solution, the aim being to read better, always better, but sometimes slower, sometimes faster. Another thing that has not changed, unfortunately, is the failure to carry instruction in reading beyond the elementary level. Most of our educational ingenuity, money, and effort is spent on reading instruction in the first 6 grades. Beyond that, little formal training is provided to carry students to higher and quite distinct levels of skill. That was true in 1939, when Professor James Mercell of Columbia University's Teachers College wrote an article for the Atlantic Monthly entitled "The Failure of the Schools." What he said then, in 2 paragraphs that I am now going to quote, is still true. Do pupils in school learn to read their mother tongue effectively? Yes and no. Up to the 5th and 6th grade, reading, on the whole, is effectively taught and well learned. To that level we find a steady and general improvement. But beyond it, the curves flatten out to a dead level. This is not because a person arrives at his natural limit of efficiency when he reaches the 6th grade, for it's been shown again and again that with special tuition, much older children, and also adults, can make enormous improvement. Nor does it mean that most 6th graders read well enough for all practical purposes. A great many pupils do poorly in high school because of sheer ineptitude in getting meaning from the printed page. They can improve, they need to improve, but they don't. The average high school graduate has done a great deal of reading, and if he goes on to college, he will do a great deal more. But he is likely to be a poor and incompetent reader. Note that this holds true of the average student, not the person who is a subject for special remedial treatment. He can follow a simple piece of fiction and enjoy it, but put him up against a closely written exposition, a carefully and economically stated argument, or a passage requiring critical consideration, and he is at a loss. It has been shown, for instance, that the average high school student is amazingly inept at indicating the central thought of a passage, or the levels of emphasis and subordination in an argument or exposition. To all intents and purposes, he remains a sixth-grade reader till well along in college. If there was a need for How to Read a Book 30 years ago, as the reception of the first edition of the book would certainly seem to indicate, the need is much greater today. But responding to that greater need is not the only, nor, for that matter, the main motive in rewriting the book. New insights into the problems of learning how to read, a much more comprehensive and better ordered analysis of the complex art of reading, the flexible application of the basic rules to different types of reading, in fact, to every variety of reading matter, the discovery and formulation of new rules of reading, and the conception of a pyramid of books to read, broad at the bottom and tapering at the top. All these things, not treated adequately or not treated at all in the book that I wrote 30 years ago, called for exposition and demanded the thorough rewriting that has now been done and is here being published. The year after How to Read a Book was published, a parody of it appeared under the title How to Read Two Books, and Professor I. A. Richards wrote a serious treatise entitled How to Read a Page. I mention both these sequels in order to point out that the problems of reading suggested by both of these titles, the jocular as well as the serious one, are fully treated in this rewriting, especially the problem of how to read a number of related books in relation to one another, and read them in such a way that the complementary and conflicting things they have to say about a common subject are clearly grasped. Among the reasons for rewriting How to Read a Book, I have stressed the things to be said about the art of reading, and the points to be made about the need for acquiring higher levels of skill in this art, which were not touched on or developed in the original version of the book. Anyone who wishes to discover how much has been added can do so quickly by comparing the present table of contents with that of the original version. Of the four parts, only part two, expounding the rules of analytical reading, closely parallels the content of the original, and even that has been largely recast. The introduction in part one of the distinction of four levels of reading, elementary, inspectional, analytical, and syntopical, is the basic and controlling change in the book's organization and content. The exposition in part three of the different ways to approach different kinds of reading materials, practical and theoretical books, imaginative literature, lyric poetry, epics, novels, plays, history, science and mathematics, social science and philosophy, as well as reference books, current journalism, and even advertising, is the most extensive addition that has been made. Finally, the discussion of syntopical reading in Part 4 is wholly new. In the work of updating, recasting, and rewriting this book, I have been joined by Charles Van Doren, who for many years now has been my associate at the Institute for Philosophical Research. We have worked together on other books, notably the 20-volume Annals of America, published by Encyclopedia Britannica, Incorporated in 1969. What is perhaps more relevant to the present cooperative venture in which we have been engaged as co-authors is that during the last 8 years, Charles Van Doren and I have worked closely together in conducting discussion groups on great books and in moderating executive seminars in Chicago, San Francisco, and Aspen. In the course of these experiences, we acquired many of the new insights that have gone into the rewriting of this book. I am grateful to Mr. Van Doren for the contribution he has made to our joint effort. And he and I, together, wish to express our deepest gratitude for all the constructive criticism, guidance, and help that we have received from our friend Arthur L. H. Rubin, who persuaded us to introduce many of the important changes that distinguish this book from its predecessor, and make it, we hope, a better and more useful book. Mortimer J. Adler, Boca Grande, March 26, 1972. Part 1. The Dimensions of Reading. Chapter 1. The Activity and Art of Reading. This is a book for readers and for those who wish to become readers. Particularly, it is for readers of books. Even more particularly, it is for those whose main purpose in reading books is to gain increased understanding. By readers, we mean people who are still accustomed, as almost every literate and intelligent person used to be, to gain a large share of their information about and their understanding of the world from the written word. Not all of it, of course. Even in the days before radio and television, a certain amount of information and understanding was acquired through spoken words and through observation. But for intelligent and curious people, that was never enough. They knew that they had to read, too, and they did read. There is some feeling nowadays that reading is not as necessary as it once was. Radio, and especially television, have taken over many of the functions once served by print, just as photography has taken over functions once served by painting and other graphic arts. Admittedly, television serves some of these functions extremely well. The visual communication of news events, for example, has enormous impact. The ability of radio to give us information while we are engaged in doing other things, for instance, driving a car, is remarkable and a great saving of time. But it may be seriously questioned whether the advent of modern communications media has much enhanced our understanding of the world in which we live. Perhaps we know more about the world than we used to, and insofar as knowledge is prerequisite to understanding, that is all to the good. But knowledge is not as much a prerequisite to understanding as is commonly supposed. We do not have to know everything about something in order to understand it. Too many facts are often as much of an obstacle to understanding as too few. There is a sense in which we moderns are inundated with facts to the detriment of understanding. One of the reasons for this situation is that the very media we have mentioned are so designed as to make thinking seem unnecessary, though this is only an appearance. The packaging of intellectual positions and views is one of the most active enterprises of some of the best minds of our day. The viewer of television, the listener to radio, the reader of magazines, is presented with a whole complex of elements, all the way from ingenious rhetoric to carefully selected data and statistics, to make it easy for him to make up his own mind with the minimum of difficulty and effort. But the packaging is often done so effectively that the viewer, listener, or reader does not make up his own mind at all. Instead, he inserts a packaged opinion into his mind, somewhat like inserting a cassette into a cassette player. He then pushes a button and plays back the opinion whenever it seems appropriate to do so. He has performed acceptably, without having had to think. Active reading. As we said at the beginning, we will be principally concerned in these pages with the development of skill in reading books. But the rules of reading that, if followed and practiced, develop such skill can be applied also to printed material in general, to any type of reading matter, to newspapers, magazines, pamphlets, articles, tracts, even advertisements. Since reading of any sort is an activity, all reading must to some degree be active. Completely passive reading is impossible. We cannot read with our eyes immobilized and our minds asleep. Hence, when we contrast active with passive reading, our purpose is first to call attention to the fact that reading can be more or less active, and second, to point out that the more active the reading, the better. One reader is better than another in proportion as he is capable of a greater range of activity in reading and exerts more effort. He is better if he demands more of himself and of the text before him. Though strictly speaking, there can be no absolutely passive reading, many people think that as compared with writing and speaking, which are obviously active undertakings, reading and listening are entirely passive. The writer or speaker must put out some effort, but no work need be done by the reader or listener. Reading and listening are thought of as receiving communication from someone who is actively engaged in giving or sending it. The mistake here is to suppose that receiving communication is like receiving a blow or a legacy or a judgment from the court. On the contrary, the reader or listener is much more like the catcher in a game of baseball. Catching the ball is just as much an activity as pitching or hitting it. The pitcher or batter is the sender in the sense that his activity initiates the motion of the ball. The catcher or fielder is the receiver in the sense that his activity terminates it. Both are active, though the activities are different. If anything is passive, it is the ball. It is the inert thing that is put in motion or stopped, whereas the players are active, moving to pitch, hit, or catch. The analogy with writing and reading is almost perfect. The thing that is written and read, like the ball, is the passive object, common to the two activities that begin and terminate the process. We can take this analogy a step further. The art of catching is the skill of catching every kind of pitch, fastballs and curves, change-ups and knucklers. Similarly, the art of reading is the skill of catching every sort of communication as well as possible. It is noteworthy that the pitcher and catcher are successful only to the extent that they cooperate. The relation of writer and reader is similar. The writer isn't trying not to be caught, although it sometimes seems so. Successful communication occurs in any case where what the writer wanted to have received finds its way into the reader's possession. The writer's skill and the reader's skill converge upon a common end. Admittedly, writers vary just as pitchers do. Some writers have excellent control. They know exactly what they want to convey, and they convey it precisely and accurately. Other things being equal, they are easier to catch than a wild writer without control. There is one respect in which the analogy breaks down. The ball is a simple unit. It is either completely caught or not. A piece of writing, however, is a complex object. It can be received more or less completely, all the way from very little of what the writer intended to the whole of it. The amount the reader catches will usually depend on the amount of activity he puts into the process, as well as upon the skill with which he executes the different mental acts involved. What does active reading entail? We will return to this question many times in this book. For the moment, it suffices to say that given the same thing to read, one person reads it better than another, first, by reading it more actively, and second, by performing each of the acts involved more skillfully. These two things are related. Reading is a complex activity just as writing is. It consists of a large number of separate acts, all of which must be performed in a good reading. The person who can perform more of them is better able to read. The goals of reading. Reading for information and reading for understanding. You have a mind. Now let us suppose that you also have a book that you want to read. The book consists of language written by someone for the sake of communicating something to you. Your success in reading it is determined by the extent to which you receive everything the writer intended to communicate. That, of course, is too simple. The reason is that there are two possible relations between your mind and the book, not just one. These two relations are exemplified by two different experiences that you can have in reading your book. There is the book, and here is your mind. As you go through the pages, either you understand perfectly everything the author has to say, or you do not. If you do, you may have gained information, but you could not have increased your understanding. If the book is completely intelligible to you from start to finish, then the author and you are as two minds in the same mold. The symbols on the page merely express the common understanding you had before you met. Let us take our second alternative. You do not understand the book perfectly. Let us even assume, what unhappily is not always true, that you understand enough to know that you do not understand at all. You know the book has more to say than you understand, and hence that it contains something that can increase your understanding. What do you do then? You can take the book to someone else who you think can read better than you and have him explain the parts that trouble you. He may be a living person or another book, a commentary or textbook. Or you may decide that what is over your head is not worth bothering about, that you understand enough. In either case, you are not doing the job of reading that the book requires. That is done in only one way. Without external help of any sort, you go to work on the book. With nothing but the power of your own mind, you operate on the symbols before you in such a way that you gradually lift yourself from a state of understanding less to one of understanding more. Such elevation, accomplished by the mind working on a book, is highly skilled reading, the kind of reading that a book which challenges your understanding deserves. Thus we can roughly define what we mean by the art of reading as follows. The process whereby a mind, with nothing to operate on but the symbols of the readable matter, and with no help from outside, elevates itself by the power of its own operations. Note, there is one kind of situation in which it is appropriate to ask for outside help in reading a difficult book. This exception is discussed in Chapter 18. The mind passes from understanding less to understanding more. The skilled operations that cause this to happen are the various acts that constitute the art of reading. To pass from understanding less to understanding more by your own intellectual effort in reading is something like pulling yourself up by your bootstraps. It certainly feels that way. It is a major exertion. Obviously, it is a more active kind of reading than you have done before, entailing not only more varied activity, but also much more skill in the performance of the various acts required. Obviously, too, the things that are usually regarded as more difficult to read, and hence as only for the better reader, are those that are more likely to deserve and demand this kind of reading. The distinction between reading for information and reading for understanding is deeper than this. Let us try to say more about it. We will have to consider both goals of reading because the line between what is readable in one way and what must be read in the other is often hazy. To the extent that we can keep these two goals of reading distinct, we can employ the word reading in two distinct senses. The first sense is the one in which we speak of ourselves as reading newspapers, magazines, or anything else that, according to our skill and talents, is at once thoroughly intelligible to us. Such things may increase our store of information, but they cannot improve our understanding, for our understanding was equal to them before we started. Otherwise, we would have felt the shock of puzzlement and perplexity that comes from getting in over our depth, that is, if we were both alert and honest. The second sense is the one in which a person tries to read something that, at first, he does not completely understand. Here, the thing to be read is initially better or higher than the reader. The writer is communicating something that can increase the reader's understanding. Such communication between unequals must be possible, or else one person could never learn from another, either through speech or writing. Here, by learning, is meant understanding more. Not remembering more information that has the same degree of intelligibility as other information you already possess. There is clearly no difficulty of an intellectual sort about gaining new information in the course of reading, if the new facts are of the same sort as those you already know. A person who knows some of the facts of American history, and understands them in a certain light, can readily acquire by reading, in the first sense, more such facts, and understand them in the same light. But suppose he's reading a history that seeks not merely to give him some more facts, but also to throw a new and perhaps more revealing light on all the facts he knows. Suppose there is greater understanding available here than he possessed before he started to read. If he can manage to acquire that greater understanding, he is reading in the second sense. He has, indeed, elevated himself by his activity, though indirectly, of course, the elevation was made possible by the writer who had something to teach him. What are the conditions under which this kind of reading, reading for understanding, takes place? There are two. First, there is initial inequality in understanding. The writer must be superior to the reader in understanding, and his book must convey, in readable form, the insights he possesses and his potential readers lack. Second, the reader must be able to overcome this inequality in some degree, seldom perhaps fully, but always approaching equality with the writer. To the extent that equality is approached, clarity of communication is achieved. In short, we can learn only from our betters. We must know who they are and how to learn from them. The person who has this sort of knowledge possesses the art of reading in the sense with which we are especially concerned in this book. Everyone who can read at all probably has some ability to read in this way. But all of us, without exception, can learn to read better and gradually gain more by our efforts through applying them to more rewarding materials. We do not want to give the impression that facts leading to increased information and insights leading to increased understanding are always easy to distinguish. And we would admit that sometimes a mere recital of facts can itself lead to greater understanding. The point we want to emphasize here is that this book is about the art of reading for the sake of increased understanding. Fortunately, if you learn to do that, reading for information will usually take care of itself. Of course, there is still another goal of reading, besides gaining information and understanding, and that is entertainment. However, this book will not be much concerned with reading for entertainment. It is the least demanding kind of reading, and it requires the least amount of effort. Furthermore, there are no rules for it. Everyone who knows how to read at all can read for entertainment if he wants to. In fact, any book that can be read for understanding or information can probably be read for entertainment as well, just as a book that is capable of increasing our understanding can also be read purely for the information it contains. This proposition cannot be reversed. It is not true that every book that can be read for entertainment can also be read for understanding. Nor do we wish to urge you never to read a good book for entertainment. The point is, if you wish to read a good book for understanding, we believe we can help you. Our subject, then, is the art of reading good books when understanding is the aim you have in view. Reading as learning. The difference between learning by instruction and learning by discovery. Getting more information is learning, and so is coming to understand what you did not understand before. But there is an important difference between these two kinds of learning. To be informed is to know simply that something is the case. To be enlightened is to know, in addition, what it is all about, why it is the case, what its connections are with other facts, in what respects it is the same, in what respects it is different, and so forth. This distinction is familiar in terms of the differences between being able to remember something and being able to explain it. If you remember what an author says, you have learned something from reading him. If what he says is true, you have even learned something about the world. But whether it is a fact about the book or a fact about the world that you have learned, you have gained nothing but information if you have exercised only your memory. You have not been enlightened. Enlightenment is achieved only when, in addition to knowing what an author says, you know what he means and why he says it. It is true, of course, that you should be able to remember what the author said as well as know what he meant. Being informed is prerequisite to being enlightened. The point, however, is not to stop at being informed. Montaigne speaks of an abecedarian ignorance that precedes knowledge, and a doctoral ignorance that comes after it. The first is the ignorance of those who, not knowing their ABCs, cannot read at all. The second is the ignorance of those who have misread many books. They are, as Alexander Pope rightly calls them, bookful blockheads, ignorantly read. There have always been literate ignoramuses who have read too widely and not well. The Greeks had a name for such a mixture of learning and folly, which might be applied to the bookish but poorly read of all ages. They are all sophomores. To avoid this error, the error of assuming that to be widely read and to be well read are the same thing, we must consider a certain distinction in types of learning. This distinction has a significant bearing on the whole business of reading and its relation to education generally. In the history of education, men have often distinguished between learning by instruction and learning by discovery. Instruction occurs when one person teaches another through speech or writing. We can, however, gain knowledge without being taught. If this were not the case, and every teacher had to be taught what he in turn teaches others, there would be no beginning in the acquisition of knowledge. Hence, there must be discovery. The process of learning something by research, by investigation, or by reflection, without being taught. Discovery stands to instruction, as learning without a teacher stands to learning through the help of one. In both cases, the activity of learning goes on in the one who learns. It would be a mistake to suppose that discovery is active learning and instruction passive. There is no inactive learning, just as there is no inactive reading. This is so true, in fact, that a better way to make the distinction clear is to call instruction aided discovery. Without going into learning theory as psychologists conceive it, it is obvious that teaching is a very special art, sharing with only two other arts, agriculture and medicine, an exceptionally important characteristic. A doctor may do many things for his patient, but in the final analysis, it is the patient himself who must get well, grow in health. The farmer does many things for his plants or animals, but in the final analysis, it is they that must grow in size and excellence. Similarly, although the teacher may help his student in many ways, it is the student himself who must do the learning. Knowledge must grow in his mind if learning is to take place. The difference between learning by instruction and learning by discovery, or, as we would prefer to say, between aided and unaided discovery, is primarily a difference in the materials on which the learner works. When he is being instructed, discovering with the help of a teacher, the learner acts on something communicated to him. He performs operations on discourse, written or oral. He learns by acts of reading or listening. Note here the close relation between reading and listening. If we ignore the minor differences between these two ways of receiving communication, we can say that reading and listening are the same art, the art of being taught. When, however, the learner proceeds without the help of any sort of teacher, the operations of learning are performed on nature or the world rather than on discourse. The rules of such learning constitute the art of unaided discovery. If we use the word reading loosely, we can say that discovery, strictly unaided discovery, is the art of reading nature or the world, as instruction, being taught or aided discovery, is the art of reading books, or, to include listening, of learning from discourse. What about thinking? If by thinking we mean the use of our minds to gain knowledge or understanding, and if learning by discovery and learning by instruction exhaust the ways of gaining knowledge, then thinking must take place during both of these two activities. We must think in the course of reading and listening, just as we must think in the course of research. Naturally, the kinds of thinking are different as the two ways of learning are. The reason why many people regard thinking as more closely associated with research and unaided discovery than with being taught is that they suppose reading and listening to be relatively effortless. It is probably true that one does less thinking when one reads for information or entertainment than when one is undertaking to discover something. These are the less active sorts of reading. But it is not true of the more active reading, the effort to understand. No one who's done this sort of reading would say it can be done thoughtlessly. Thinking is only one part of the activity of learning. One must also use one's senses and imagination. One must observe and remember. and construct imaginatively what cannot be observed. There is again a tendency to stress the role of these activities in the process of unaided discovery, and to forget or minimize their place in the process of being taught through reading or listening. For example, many people assume that though a poet must use his imagination in writing a poem, they do not have to use their imagination in reading it. The art of reading, in short, includes all of the same skills that are involved in the art of unaided discovery: keenness of observation, readily available memory, range of imagination, and, of course, an intellect trained in analysis and reflection. The reason for this is that reading in this sense is discovery too, although with help instead of without it. Present and absent teachers. We have been proceeding as if reading and listening could both be treated as learning from teachers. To some extent, that is true. Both are ways of being instructed, and for both one must be skilled in the art of being taught. Listening to a course of lectures, for example, is in many respects like reading a book, and listening to a poem is like reading it. Many of the rules to be formulated in this book apply to such experiences. Yet there is good reason to place primary emphasis on reading, and let listening become a secondary concern. The reason is that listening is learning from a teacher who is present, a living teacher, while reading is learning from one who is absent. If you ask a living teacher a question, he will probably answer you. If you are puzzled by what he says, you can save yourself the trouble of thinking by asking him what he means. If, however, you ask a book a question, you must answer it yourself. In this respect, a book is like nature or the world. When you question it, it answers you only to the extent that you do the work of thinking and analysis yourself. This does not mean, of course, that if the living teacher answers your question, you have no further work. That is so only if the question is simply one of fact. But if you are seeking an explanation, you have to understand it, or nothing has been explained to you. Nevertheless, with the living teacher available to you, you are given a lift in the direction of understanding him, as you are not when the teacher's words in a book are all you have to go by. Students in school often read difficult books with the help and guidance of teachers. But for those of us who are not in school, and indeed also for those of us who are, when we try to read books that are not required or assigned, our continuing education depends mainly on books alone, read without a teacher's help. Therefore, if we are disposed to go on learning and discovering, we must know how to make books teach us well. That, indeed, is the primary goal of this book.